Mark.
To announce that I am willing to meet the class today at 4:15 in this room to answer questions. It will be just a question and answer period. I'm not going to lecture. But students have come up with questions, and it would take a long time to answer some of them, and I think it would be a better organization of our time if we would devote a special period for this purpose. So please, today at 4:15, from 4:15 to 5, in this room, if you have any questions, I would suggest it might be better if you were to write them out and then give them to me at the beginning of the hour at 4:15. And I'm not promising you that I will answer all the questions, but I promise you that I will try to do so. Now, we were discussing, if I may have your attention, a contrast between the two senses of time and history. On the one hand, the biblical, which is more or less linear in nature, a straight line. And on the other hand, the cyclical view. And I only sketched briefly the biblical conception of the movement of time and history, and then left that alone and, by way of contrast, discussed the Greek cyclical view. Now, let me continue with that. The early Christian church fathers were challenged at times by Greek philosophers on the question of the nature of time, and the matter became one of serious controversy. St. Augustine devoted some of his best long chapters, many chapters of his works, his Confessions and the City of God, to the problem of time. Church fathers were preoccupied with this. It was no trifling matter because the issues were very grave ones. One of the controversies was between a pagan thinker by the name of Celsus, who was answered by one of the great church fathers, Origen. And this is what Origen wrote, as part of what he wrote, as an answer to Celsus, sometimes called Celsum, but more generally Celsus. If the view of cyclical time is true, he wrote, this was in the second century, if this view is right, is true, then free will is destroyed. For if it is inevitable that in the period of mortal life, according to the determined cycles, the same things always have happened, are now happening, and will happen, it is obviously inevitable that Socrates will always be a philosopher and be accused of introducing new deities and corrupting the youth. Anytus and Miletus will always be accusing Socrates, and the council on the Areopagus will vote for his condemnation to death by hemlock. The reply to this assumption of Celsus will be that it is inevitable, according to the determined cycles, that Moses will always come out of Egypt with the people of the Jews, Jesus will again come to visit this life and will do the same things that he has done, and not just once, but an infinite number of times, according to the cycles. Furthermore, the same people will be Christians in the determined cycles. And again, Celsus will write his book, though he has written it before an infinite number of times. Now, this is an example of the sharp contrast that was seen by the Christian church fathers between the cyclical view and the biblical view. Now, it is true, and one must state this, that for perhaps about 1,000 years in the medieval period, from roughly, say, 400 to 1400, the biblical idea seems to have been lost by the church. And ironically, despite the fact that the church at that time was playing the dominant role in Europe, which could have been and was identified with Christendom. And perhaps the following might be the reasons for this. First, the Catholic thinkers, who were greatly influenced by Aristotle, became more concerned with timelessness, timeless reality, and became conscious Aristotelians and unconscious Platonists. And this was quite different from the biblical conception, which was not concerned with the timeless, but with time and its uses and its events. And secondly, medieval life, medieval science became static. The Christian thought got to emphasize rest as being better than motion, being better than becoming, that being is reality and becoming is appearance or illusion. And this trend of thought continued with some modifications even through the Renaissance, which was largely influenced by Plato's thought. Even thinkers like Machiavelli and Francis Bacon seemed to be identified with the concept of time as cyclical. But the modern period, starting with roughly the 18th century, broke with that. And of course, to us, the notion of time being cyclical is a rather peculiar one, or a fantastic one. And one has to force oneself to try to think of that idea sympathetically. But with the 18th century, the biblical concept was restored. I'm not suggesting that it was done consciously. In some cases, it was done consciously, a rediscovery of the biblical insight. But in many cases, it was probably done unconsciously on the basis of secular thought, which in the 18th century was one that played a dominant role. Now, in order further to sharpen the contrast which will illuminate the biblical conception, and also to show us the importance for our thinking, which is what we're concerned with, we have certain definite purposes in mind, I want to state briefly, as I told you I would do, the cyclical view as it was conceived by the people of India, particularly in Hinduism and in Buddhism. These are quite important for cultural reasons in any case. There are today approximately 500 million Hindus and perhaps some 250 million Buddhists. So their thought still is a matter of vital concern to us. Now, the Indians, like the ancient Hebrews, were troubled by the problem of suffering. It's very interesting to see how a division took place. You can have the same problem and the same concern, the same sense of dedication to a problem. You can move, however, in one way or in another way, and it'll make all the difference in the world. The Indian people, like the ancient Hebrews, could not reconcile themselves to the idea that suffering is maybe meaningless from the moral or religious point of view. It couldn't be squared with the concept of the universe, a cosmos, an orderly place in which man lives and works. There had to be some explanation that would be morally and religiously satisfying for the way suffering exists in the world. It doesn't exist in any orderly way. It seems to be chaotic, striking anybody, the righteous and the unrighteous alike. Well, there must be some reason for it. Well, they hit upon what became the central idea to them of what they called karma. Karma can be differently identified, translated, but by and large, and this would be the best way of looking at it for our purposes, it means universal causality. A cosmic principle identified as karma, according to which each person is rewarded or punished for his deeds. The soul is deathless, and it passes on after the death of the body by transmigration into other bodies and becomes reincarnated, the theory of reincarnation. The reincarnation may be in the body of an animal, of an insect. It may be in the body of a human being. But this is an endless or an almost endless process. So suffering now, a person who's alive now, is to be explained by the sins, the wrongs, the evils that he committed in a previous incarnation, in a previous life form. If a person is not punished now, when he ought to be punished, seeing what he does, and yet he's not punished, well, he will be punished in the next life form or in a later life form. One doesn't know just when it will be. It may take 10,000 years for the process, or more. But at some point or other, he will pay the price that he's required to pay. Each person carries with him, as it were, an account with credits and debits. There's no escape from this accounting operation, except through ultimately, hopefully, with difficulty, through nirvana. Nirvana is hard to explain, but as I get it, it's a state in which the will and the passions are blown out. This is a figure of speech that is used like a candle that gets blown out. One who achieves nirvana gets off the wheel of existence. And at last he is free from this process of endless reincarnations and karmic suffering. The nirvana is explained as a means of extinction of the fire of desire or the will to live. You find some of this, of course, dealt with by Schopenhauer, who was concerned with the will, who borrowed from Indian thought. It's been influential in our Western culture, too. There's a lot of this in Emerson and in Thoreau, transcendentalism generally, idealism generally. There have been influences, but that's not our present concern. But I'm referring to them because the idea is, should not be a very strange one. The desire to escape from desire itself, to become passionless, even with respect to the basic desire to live. Whether or not nirvana also means the end of the life of the soul, one cannot say. Buddha himself refused or couldn't answer this question. There were four questions that he wouldn't or couldn't answer, and this was one of them. Now, some Indian thinkers say a cycle takes about 12,000 years, but some have calculated as many as 430,000 years. But in any case, it's a long, long time for the karmic cycle to work itself out. Let me quote to you a number of expressions which will give you the flavor and perhaps a deeper insight into this matter. With respect to the inequities and inequalities that we run into daily in our lives, only karma, wrote one authority on the subject, only karma can explain, and I'm quoting, the mysterious problem of good and evil, and reconcile man to the terrible apparent, and the word apparent is in italics, apparent injustice of life. That is, life is not really unjust, but may appear to be unjust. For when one unacquainted with the noble doctrine looks around him and observes the inequalities of birth and fortune, of intellect and capacities, when one sees honor paid to fools and profligates, and their nearest neighbor with all his intellect and noble virtues, one sees him perishing of want and for lack of sympathy. When one sees all this and has to turn away helpless to relieve the undeserved suffering, the blessed knowledge of karma alone prevents him from cursing life and men, as well as their creator. Nothing, says this writer, this authority, is more untrue than the cry that all men are born equal. They are not. Each is born with a burden, pleasant or unpleasant, of his own karma. And no two men are equal, for no two men are the same. Cripples, dwarfs, and those born deaf or blind are the products of their own past actions. They can't blame even their parents. It's not heredity in a physical sense. It's karma that explains why people are born the way they are. They even explain infant prodigies, say Yehudi Menuhin playing on the concert stage at the age of five. How does that happen? They say karma explains that. One can, through karma, even acquire such talent, such genius. so that the child, almost an infant, hardly more than an infant, is already able to pick up the violin and to play it as if for 20 or 30 years he had been practicing on the instrument. This is another statement by another authority. From the Buddhist... For 2,000 years have Christians heard it proclaimed from their pulpits, be not deceived. This is a quotation from the New Testament that the author cites. Be not deceived, he writes. God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. From the Buddhist viewpoint, karma stresses the converse of this Christian presentation of the law. Whatsoever a man reaps, say the Buddhists, that also he has sown. It's the reverse stress. What you sow, you will reap. This would be the biblical statement. But the Buddhist or the Hindu reverses the order. What you reap is what you've already sown. You may have sown it 1,000 years ago, but you've sown it and now you're reaping it. Believing in the operation of natural justice, Buddhism would say in reply to the biblical inquiry, who did sin? This man or his parents, that he was born blind? That it was this man who had sinned? That is, had so behaved in a previous life as to cause, in the life in question, the effect of blindness. Afflictions are for Buddhists so many forms, not of prepayment by which future compensation may be claimed, but of settlement of outstanding debts accruing from bad, that is to say, from evil-bringing, unhappiness-promoting acts done either in this life or in previous lives. In karmas to be found in conjunction with its common sense corollary, rebirth, reincarnation, a natural and therefore reasonable answer to the apparent injustice of the daily round. Why should this man be born a beggar? This man born a prince? Why this man a cripple? This man a genius? That man a fool? Why this a high-born Indian woman and that a low-born Englishman? These are effects. As it is man who suffers the effects, so it is man who generates the cause, and having done so, he cannot flee the consequences. Then the author cites one of the holy books of Buddhism. By oneself, evil is done. By oneself, one suffers. By oneself, evil is left undone. By oneself, one is purified. And again, not in the sky, not in the midst of the sea, nor anywhere else on earth is there a spot where a man may be freed from the consequences of an evil deed. Thus every man is the molder and the sole creator of his life to come and the master of his destiny. That which is done can, by the doer, be in time, as it were, neutralized. That which is yet to be depends on the deeds now being done. There is no cruel nemesis, only the slow and perfect action of an all-embracing law. And finally, this brief passage. But even as the causes generated by one man react upon that man, so the mass causation of a group, this affects not only the individual, but there is also group karma. Be it a family, a society, or a nation, reacts upon that group as such, and upon all whose karma placed them at the time therein. Each man, therefore, has several karmas. There's a racial karma, a national karma, a family karma, and a personal karma. Yet all quite properly his karma, else he would not have found himself subject to their sway. That is, in his life, he can bring together upon himself his own karma, which includes his racial, national, and family karma as well. From this point of view, says the author, we cease to complain of our circumstances. Now, I want to stress this. What I'm reading to you is not just to take up your time to listen to me. Some of you may be a little bit restless here. But if you listened, you probably wouldn't be. So the point here is that we must not complain of our circumstances. And we must cease from turning with the weakness of a child to a man-made God to save us from the natural consequences of our acts. Karma is no god, for the gods themselves are subject to its sway. Only the ignorant personify karma and attempt to bribe, petition, or cajole it. Wise men understand it and conform to it. Much of the emphasis in the concept of karma is to become reconciled to one's condition. This has played a very important role in the lives of the Indian people and of other peoples. Karma, for example, with the belief in cyclical time, explained and supported the caste system in India, including untouchability. Gandhi came head-on in collision with this problem. There were some 50 million, today perhaps around 80 million, untouchables in India at the time when Gandhi was concerned with them. And the Hindus argued with the upper caste in Hindus argued with Gandhi that he was being a traitor to his own religion, to his own ideology, to the whole system of thought which Hinduism represented. Louis Fisher, in his important life of Gandhi, deals with this. Let me touch on this briefly, because we're touching here an extremely crucial moral point. To perpetuate caste, it has been clothed in the sacred formula of immutable fate. You are a Brahmin or a Sudra or an untouchable because of your conduct in a previous incarnation. Your misbehavior in the present life might result in a caste demotion in the next life. A high caste Hindu could be reborn an untouchable. The soul of a sinner might even be transferred to an animal. An untouchable could become a Brahmin in the next incarnation. A woman might become a man in the next incarnation, and vice versa. Some Hindus would like to feel that at rebirth, they will still be members of the same family, though their relationship may be altered. A husband and wife may become a brother and a sister, for example, or a sister and a brother, the reverse. Men with feminine propensities might turn women in the next incarnation. A person who is bloodthirsty and vicious may fall to animal status. A spiritual person may be reborn a Brahmin. A greedy Brahmin may be reborn in the merchant caste. Thus, conduct alters inheritance. But once caste rank is fixed in any one incarnation, it is destiny. According to this doctrine, an untouchable is merely doing penance. To interrupt it by raising his status robs him of a possible ticket to a high caste in the next incarnation. This prospect reconciles religious untouchables to their current misery. And this is the way it operated. So Gandhi was rebuked. That is, a Hindu, a high caste Hindu, he should oppose untouchability. And his answer was, if to be a Hindu means to believe in untouchability, then I am not a Hindu. In due time, of course, we know he was influential, he won disciples. He said, I do not want to be reborn, but if I have to be reborn, I should be reborn an untouchable, so that I may share the sorrows of the untouchables, their sufferings, and the affronts leveled against them, in order that I may endeavor to free myself and them from their miserable condition. Now, karma does not involve remembrance of one's past, what one has done. And Gandhi commented on that, and he said that was a great mercy. And I think that's probably true. The burden would be an unbearable one if one had to remember, if one believed in reincarnation, all that went on in previous incarnations. But for us, for the non-Hindu, the absence of memory removes the previous incarnations. But for us, for the non-Hindu, the absence of memory removes the moral foundation for present suffering. For example, if a person commits a great crime, say murder, and when he's brought to trial, it is clear from the medical testimony that he suffers from amnesia. He has forgotten his past. He cannot be brought to trial in our system. If he's insane at the time of trial, even though he may have been sane at the time of the commission of the crime, but if he's insane at the time of the trial, he is not tried. Ezra Pound, for example, was charged with treasonable conduct in Italy during the time of the war, adjudged to have been insane when he was brought to this country for trial, wasn't tried. He was he spent, I don't know, 10, 12 years in a medical hospital. Oh, we would be shocked from the point of view of Western thought if our administration of criminal justice operated in any other way. So that the absence of memory in Hindu thought to us means removing the underpinnings, the moral underpinnings, from the whole operation of the karmic principle. I think that the influence of cyclical beliefs on the Indian people, in part, these things are very complex, of course, and I don't want anybody to think that I'm dogmatic on a matter of this kind, which is purely speculation. But others have thought about this. It's not my invention, that it may very well be that some aspects of Indian life can be explained by their belief in karma and in reincarnation. As contrasted with Western society, one finds in Indian society a general indifference. It's been changing recently because they've become secularized and westernized and Christianized. You can't judge thousands of years of history by what's happening in the last 10, 20 years. But with the sweep of the past before us, Indian society on the whole has been rather indifferent to surroundings, to environment, to the problem of worldly well-being, to poverty, cruelty, sickness. There's been a general acquiescence in evil, in wrongdoing. a disinclination to blame society, to blame the environment, a kind of the of an acceptance of the status quo, a sort of status quoism, a quietism, which goes with even today with some aspects of Indian life and Indian thought. You could see it in relation to untouchability as Gandhi met that problem, which was a very crucial problem. This wasn't a matter for thought, this was a matter for action. And the society wouldn't act because this was an interference with the cosmic order. Indians are said to lack a historical consciousness. This has been noted by scholars who are concerned with philosophies of history. It has been said time and again that the histories of India and of Japan and of Burma and of China have been written by Westerners and not by their own scholars. But they seem to have lacked a concern with history and a sense of history. It's a Western sense and not an Eastern sense. Now, the Greeks, who also had the cyclical conception, as we have seen, however, didn't take it that seriously. And they didn't give it a moral translation. They used the idea. But to them, it became a constructive idea because it became the basis for an interest in science. In science, you need repetition. You deal with phenomena that are repetitive. You deal with experiments that you can repeat. You don't deal with the unique in science. You deal with the typical, with the things that are repetitive. So that the cyclical idea can be a productive one, depending on how it's used and the way it was used eventually by the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, became the basis for philosophy and for scientific development. But with the Indians, they did not have this concern. But their concern was the moral one. And then they gave it the kind of use and translation which we have been concerned with, at least from my point of view, the point of view of others who share this position, with catastrophic social results. Now, if I may go back to the Bible and pick up the train of thought, I hope that by now, with these discussions that we've had of the Greeks and the Hindus and Buddhists, you can see more sharply what it is that we're discussing. In the Bible, let me clear this matter up right at the beginning, there is cyclical time too. Now, I want to explain that. For the natural order, for the order of nature, including man as part of the order of nature, there is cyclical time. For example, in Genesis, right after the flood, God said, "While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease." Well, this is a beautiful example of the operation of the cycle. In Ecclesiastes, in chapter 1, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind. And on its circuits, the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Very moving, a very poetic expression of the idea of cyclical time. But when it comes to man as a moral agent, as distinguished from man as part of the natural order, as part of the natural order, he is just like all the other things that have been mentioned, no different from birds or insects, any other living part of nature. But as a moral agent, as a doer of deeds, as an actor, he is on a linear line, is on linear time. The line that we have drawn the other day on the board. Now let me look at this, let's look at it from a number of points of view. First of all, the biblical religions, and this would include Islam as well as, of course, Judaism and Christianity, are all historical religions. Now this statement has been made any number of times, you've heard it, you've seen it in print, but in this context, it takes on a special meaning. And it makes, from one point of view, the point that we've been discussing. The central beliefs in Judaism and in Christianity, I don't know too much about Islam, so we're not going to point to talk about that. The central beliefs all relate to events in history. That is what are said to be events in history. The Exodus, Sinai, the covenants that have been made, the covenant with Abraham, the covenant with Israel, the life, death, and the resurrection of Jesus, the election of Israel, and from the Christian point of view, the election of the church, as St. Paul uses the concept of election to apply it to the church in his letter to the Romans. The belief in the coming of the Messiah. These are all dealt with as historical events. These religions are not the religions of abstractions, as Pascal said it in the famous phrase in a paper that he left that was found after his death. The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, not the God of philosophers and of scholars. And of course, this is the position of Judaism and of Christianity. So that history is the very foundation, the very warp and woof of these religions, inextricable. Secondly, time, motion, change, becoming are not mere appearances in biblical thought. Birth and death are real events. And man has only one opportunity for his life on the earth, to make it a good life or to make it a bad life, to make it blessed or to make it cursed. There is no belief in immortality in the Hebrew scriptures. This may come as a shock to some of you, or maybe all of you, but there is no belief so stated in the Hebrew scriptures. On death, something leaves the body, the breath of life as it's referred to, ruach in Hebrew, whatever it is, it leaves the body and it goes to a place called Sheol or Abaddon, which is a kind of an underworld, a pit for the dead man's shades or ghosts. There are a few places, like the story about the Witch of Endor, where there is the suggestion that it might be possible through witchcraft, which of course one is prohibited from practicing, to call up a shade. But there's practically no suggestion, with these small exceptions that are not really very productive, that the shades are even conscious. There are more statements that imply their non-activity. Let me cite one or two examples. Psalm 88. Dost thou work wonders for the dead? Do the shades arise up to praise thee? This is addressed to God. Is thy steadfast love declared in the grave, or thy faithfulness in Abaddon? Are thy wonders known in the darkness, or thy saving help in the land of forgetfulness? It's a description of Sheol or Abaddon. It's a hell of a place. It's no place that one wants to go to. It's not hell in the later conception. There's no intimation that it's a place where people are punished. It's a place where one is cut off from God. That's more than anything else is the reason why one doesn't want to go there. As this psalm states, there's no relationship there between man and God. In Psalm 94, If the Lord had not been my help, my soul would have dwelt in the land of silence, as I would have died and would have gone to the land of silence. Or Psalm 115, the dead do not praise the Lord, nor do any that go down in silence. Well, I want to continue this, but I'm afraid our time is up at this point.